scattered showers and thunderstorms before midnight, then some isolated showers. There's a slight chance of showers Friday morning, and then it will be mostly cloudy, a high of 75. Saturday looks to be the best day of the weekend, partly sunny, a high of 79. And then you can thank me, all of you who are lamenting the lack of rain, because I am starting my vacation on Sunday. And as far as the eye can see, there is a chance of showers Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, with highs in the mid-70s to low 80s.
Are you looking to get your message in front of a qualified audience through all the noise out there today? Consider taking an advertisement out on Hunterdon Chamber Radio, WHCR, DB, the voice of business. Contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org.
We leave our homes in the morning. We kiss our children goodbye. While we slave for the bosses, our children scream and cry. And when we draw our money, our grocery bills to pay, not a cent to spend for clothing, not a cent to lay away. And on that very evening, our little son will say, I need some shoes, Mother, and so does Sister May. How it grieves the heart of a mother, you everyone must know. But we can't buy for our children, our wages are too low. It is for our little children that seem to us so dear, but for us nor them, dear workers, the bosses do not care. But understand the workers, our union they do fear. Let's stand together, workers, and have a union here.
Good morning and welcome to the Library Show. I'm Jennifer Winberry. Jim Thatch is out saving the world this week, and we are coming to you live from the Chamber of Commerce offices on Main Street, the building currently shrouded in blue. You just heard the Mill Mother's Lament, played by Pete Seeger from his American Industrial Ballad album. And now I am playing the ghost of Ella Mae Wiggins. And the reason I am playing this, on today's show, I will be speaking with New York Times bestselling author Wiley Cash, whose third book, The Last Ballad, was released on Tuesday by William Morrow. And Wiley's book is the novelization of the story of Ella Mae Wiggins. It's based on the true story. She was 28 years old in 1929. She lived in Gastonia, North Carolina. And she's the mother of five surviving children whose husband has left her. Each day, Ella Mae walks over 2 miles to work 6 days a week at a textile mill for 12 hours each day, only to earn 9 hours a day. The Goldbergs, who own the mill, feel they are more than fair to their employees, but Ella Mae is afraid to take even one day off to care for her sick child. When union organizers come to the area, they pique Ella Mae's interest, and even though it means giving up a day off with her children, she travels to the next town where she becomes active in the union and visible as she sings a song she wrote, which you just heard, The Mill Mother's Lament, a song that remains a touchstone in the history of the labor movement. So at the 11:15 break, I will be calling Wiley, who has taken time from his book tour, which has just gotten underway, to talk to us for a little while. Also, in today's library show, we're going to talk about the photo show. It's the amateur photo show, which is mounted in the main gallery at the headquarters library. Jim figures it's been about 20 years that we've been having this. The photos are all hung. They've all been judged by local author and artist Walter Horseshoeski. And the winners will be announced at the awards ceremony on the 11th of October, next Wednesday. And after the award ceremony, Walter will present iconic images, stories behind famous photographs. You still have time to vote for viewer's choice, so come on in, take a look at all the pictures, and vote for your favorite. And please, only one vote per person. Also, well, next time you're at the library for a program, check out the new stage lighting in the meeting room. This was just recently installed by Salem Electric, thanks to the generosity of the Friends of the Hunterdon County Library. And if you were at last night's concert, Due South, a Southern rock band and contemporary country, very appropriate, given our guest today from the South, you will have seen the stage lighting. There's going to be a picture on Facebook a little bit later. And it's pretty spectacular looking for our meeting room. It's starting to look like a real auditorium. And one last thing before I go to the first commercial break and give Wiley a call is I do want to give a shout-out to Patrick O'Brien, whose birthday is today. And Patrick has been my cousin for his entire life. So happy birthday, Patrick. I hope you're having a super day. I know it's a little bit early for the first commercial break, but I do want to go there now so that I can give Wiley a call. So when I come back, I will have author Wiley Cash.
This is Chamber President Chris Phelan inviting you to the 29th Annual Business and Home Expo with our Restaurant Showcase. This wonderful event will happen on Thursday, November 9th at our new location, Next Level Arena on Case Boulevard in Flemington from 2 to 7 p.m. If you're a business or organization would like to participate, contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or visit our website at hunterdonchamber.org. You're listening to WHCR-DB, HunterdonChamberRadio.com. Brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
This is Tony Clark, para planner at Patton Heidi & Associates. Americans believe they should be in charge of their own future, how they will live tomorrow. Since 1894, Ameriprise Financial has worked for their clients' futures, helping millions of Americans retire on their terms, when they want, where they want, doing what they want. Today, Patton Heidi & Associates, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., remains true to the vision of always putting clients first. We are ready to help you put a confident retirement more within reach. Put the strength of a leader in retirement planning to work for you through a personal one-to-one relationship. Patton Heidi & Associates will work with you to develop a plan to help you pursue your retirement goals. Call today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 1318 Route 31 North, Annandale, New Jersey. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor, Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC.
Everybody over there!
Get on up!
Everybody out there!
Get into it!
Everybody right there!
Get involved!
Everybody, you!
Did you know the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce has over 20 active committees that you can participate in? Committees range from focus on business and government to economic development to events like our annual business expo. Contact the Chamber for more information today at 908-782-7115 or email us at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Welcome back to the Library Show. If all went well, I have Wiley Cash on the phone.
I'm here.
You're here. Wonderful. I pushed all the right buttons. Well, I want to thank Wiley for taking some time out. You are on the second day of your book tour.
I am on. So I had an event in Asheville Tuesday night, Asheville, North Carolina, and I was in Spartanburg, South Carolina last night. And then so this is the third day of the book tour.
Okay. And you are in Gastonia.
I'll be in Gastonia tonight at the mill where this that my novel centers around, the Luray Mill, where the strike occurred in 1929.
Okay, we talked a little bit. I talked a little bit about your book before I gave you a call. You grew up in Gastonia, is that correct?
I did, yes.
How did you come across the story? Was it something that all the school children learned about, or?
No, you know, like most really controversial moments in American history, I didn't learn a thing about it. You know, this is a mill strike that involved two murders and made headlines around the world. It was a communist-led mill strike. And once the strike was broken in the fall of 1929, it was literally swept from history. And I grew up there. My parents grew up there nearby, and they never heard anything about the Lori Mills strike or the woman who was murdered, who became the face of it, a woman named Ella Mae Wiggins. And it wasn't until I went to graduate school in Louisiana in 2003 that I first heard about the strike.
Okay, so this has been kind of floating around in your head since for 14 years, thinking someday you wanted to tell Ella Mae's story?
Yeah, kind of. You know, I went to graduate school it was a PhD in creative writing. It's a literature-based creative writing program. So I have, you know, a standard PhD in American Lit, but my dissertation was a novel. My dissertation was actually my first novel, Landmark Kind and Home. And I just didn't feel like my understanding of craft was sharp enough to tackle a project like this expansive novel. And I didn't think my talents or capabilities as a researcher were quite powerful enough to try to research an event like this and corral it into some kind of narrative. So I sat with it for a lot of years, and I talked about it a lot. People were so tired of me talking about it. They just kept saying, why don't you write this book? And my agent kept saying, please don't write this book. But I finally did, and I think it's everything I wanted it to be.
What made you decide to write it as a novel rather than a history or a biography?
I just felt like, you know, I'd studied it so much by the time I put pen to page. I'd studied it so much that the facts of it, I just internalized them. And I didn't have to think. The facts just came to me automatically, the way that, you know, gravity and weather and sunlight and things like that come to me automatically. And so there wasn't much excitement for me in recasting the facts and recounting the facts. But what there was great excitement in was recreating the experience of what it felt like to be a working mother of four children, having lost one, who's working 72 hours a week and the night shift at a mill and making $9 a week. I was really interested in what the experience of that felt like. You know, what was the experience of being a progressive mill owner who believes himself to be very, you know, forward-thinking and fair until he's called on to deliver on that ideology? What did it feel like to be caught in that moment, or to be an African-American labor organizer coming down from New York City to the Deep South to organize black workers? You know, what kind of fear was involved in that? And so I knew the facts of those things, but I wanted to use those facts and maybe move a little deeper.
Okay. Now, Ella lives in Stumptown, and she lives among African-Americans. And her best friend, Violet, is a black woman. And even the mill workers were very forward-thinking. And yet, when Ella wants the white mill workers and the black mill workers to be in the same union, there still seems to be some hesitation, even though they're all in the same boat.
Sure, yeah. You know, Ella had come down from the mountains of East Tennessee and Western North Carolina in the early part of the 20th century. And by 1929, she was white, she was living in a predominantly African-American community, and she was working in an integrated mill, and it was one of the only integrated mills in the county. And that wasn't because the owners of that mill were progressive, it was because their wages were so low that white people refused to work there. And Ella Mae had left a number of mill jobs in the area. She'd had some conflicts, her husband was no good, they had to move around a lot, and this was literally the only work that she could find. So her neighbors were black, her friends were black. She cared for their children, they cared for her children, they helped each other out. And then when she joined the strike at Loray, which is 7 miles to the east of where she worked in Bessemer City, she saw the strike, the union was all white. And, you know, these organizers were from New York City, and they talked about equality, they talked about equal pay for equal work. So Ella went to them and said, hey, if you want to shut down some mills, we need to get black workers to join the strike. You're talking about equality. And the organizers of the strike said, equality is kind of a tricky word. If we bring in African-Americans to walk on the picket line beside these white farmers and these white mountaineers from Appalachia, whites aren't going to stand for it. And Ella said, our poverty unites us much more than our skin color divides us. And they fought integration until finally Ella was able to integrate the mill after some serious tragedy unfolded that summer.
And the mill workers, the mill owners, the Goldberg brothers, they own the mill and they're Jewish. They're considered white, but they're not considered American. So there's still this social class structure.
Yes, absolutely. You know, this is 1929. This is, you know, and the Goldberg brothers arrived mid 19-teens, I believe, in Bessemer City. They fled Latvia. After the invasion there, they were Latvian Jews, and they landed in Bessemer City, and they had accents. They looked a little different. They were from a different place. And where I'm from in North Carolina, it's almost strictly Protestant. White people have most of the power and most of the wealth, especially in the early 20th century. And so they would have allowed the Goldberg brothers to be, quote-unquote, part of society, but there would always have been an intense awareness by the Goldberg brothers that they were not part of society. As a matter of fact, I recently discovered after finishing the book that the Goldberg brothers, one of them built an enormous mansion in Gastonia, just an enormous mansion, and he built it to resemble a country club for Jewish people because Jews were not allowed membership at the country club in Gastonia. So he built this enormous mansion, and he treated it, and his friends treated it like a country club because they knew they were separate. They knew they were apart.
And yet they kept their workers apart. It completely boggles my mind. But I guess even in today's world, we're still seeing.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, where Ella worked in this mill, it was an integrated mill, but the blacks and white workers didn't work alongside. They worked in separate parts of the mill.
Right.
They did the same job in separate parts of the mill.
I think you and I talked about it before I brought you on. Your event tonight is in the Laurie Mill.
It is.
And it's been converted into luxury apartments.
It has. Yeah, well, Laurie was built in 1900, and when it was built by local investors in Gaston County. It was one of the largest mills in the country, and it's still just an enormous place. But the mill sold to Rhode Island Company in the 19-teens, and then after the strike, it sold to Firestone in the 1930s. And I always knew it as the Firestone plant. Well, it had been closed up and kind of, you know, forgotten for decades. And Preservation North Carolina, which is a nonprofit historical society in North Carolina, purchased the mill, and they've spent with the developer the last several years renovating it. And it's just a gorgeous place now. What they've done that's really, really wonderful is they've held on to the history of the mill. There's a museum inside the mill
that talks
about
the
founding of the mill and the strike and the role of people like Ella Mae Wiggins and this tragic death of a police chief who was shot during a raid on Stryker's headquarters. And so they've brought it into the modern age, but they've also done a great job of maintaining the original integrity, the structural integrity, and the design of the mill, and speaking to the past at the same time. But they took RSVPs for the event tonight, and they stopped them at 350. So we're expecting.
Oh wow, good
pretty,
for you!
Pretty good sized crowd, so I'm excited.
Oh wow, that is fabulous. How was the reception in your hometown to this book?
I don't know yet. I haven't been there. I no longer live there. Okay. I haven't lived in Gastonia since 1996 when I went to college. And my parents moved from Gastonia down to the coast of North Carolina in 1998. And so I don't know. You know, this is still a very controversial strike. Gastonia was in possession of a historical marker marking the 1929 Loray strike for almost a decade before they could agree to put it up. They just put it up a couple of years ago in front of the mill. And so this is still an incredibly contentious historic moment in Gaston County's history. So I don't quite know what the reception, but I'm hoping all 350 people aren't coming to yell at me. I'm hoping some of them are coming to celebrate the book and you know, the legacy of Ella Mae and the legacy of the strike.
And you found her tombstone in Gastonia, but it's spelled incorrect.
I did. When she was buried, in September of 1929. She was shot and killed on the way to a rally in support of some jailed strikers. And
which is not a spoiler alert.
It's not a spoiler alert.
It's pretty early on.
Early on in the novel, I wanted the reader to know that Ella was going to be murdered because I wanted every moment of celebration and every moment of tragedy that she experiences, I wanted the reader to have the extra weight of knowing she was going to be killed. And that was really, really important to me, for the reader to understand that. There are a lot of lives in this novel, and hers is the only one that's taken. But I wanted those moments of her with her children, of her integrating the labor union, of her writing and singing these, you know, foundational protest ballads. I wanted the reader to know she doesn't make it, and I wanted that existential moment to live with the reader.
It is very heartbreaking, and one of the reviewers said that it was revealed too early, so the tension was gone, and I completely disagreed with that, because I thought it was important to know. These are going to be the last time she sees her babies, because she felt so strongly about family, and she has one day off a week, and her children are everything to her, and yet she leaves them to go to try to organize this union.
Yeah, and I think early on a lot of people who were reading it said, you know, contemporary readers are going to think she doesn't love her children. And I told them, I said, look, she's making $9 a week, and she's already had a child die. The real Ella Mae had four children die from whooping cough. She'd had nine children and four of them had died. And she knows if she keeps working this job and life keeps going the way that it is, her kids are going to die, and she may die. And so she has no other choice but to make this great leap of faith and get involved in the union and try to shut these mills down and try to bargain for a better wage.
Yeah, I didn't see it as a oh, you've ruined the ending. I saw it as a way to really drive home how much her family meant to her.
Sure.
And how important it was to her. I really loved the structure of your novel. You start with Ella May's story. It's her story. She's front and center. It gives it this immediacy. And then it switches to a letter her daughter Lily is writing to Lily's nephew 76 years later. But and so many historical novels, I find they start with the letter. I'm telling you the story. So when you go, it's more like a flashback. It's not really happening. So I really liked that. And then different people, Virgil Park chimed in, the McAdams, and they all revealed different aspects of the story, but it was always Ella May's story. It wasn't these people reflecting on Ella May.
And that was a really fun thing to do. That was the original setup of the novel. And so little is actually known about Ella May's life. We know when she was born. We know kind of where she settled. She did go down to Cowpens in the early part of the 19-teens, in the middle of the 19-teens. We know that she ended up in Stumptown. We know she joined the strike. We know she was murdered. We know the dates and deaths of her children, for the most part, the birth dates and deaths of her children, for the most part. But that's not enough to build a life on. And so I really wanted to create the life of Ella May, but I also wanted to show how her life was perceived by others as she passed through their lives, because she touches the life of so many people in these very significant ways. And that was a really, really fun part of writing the novel, was constructing these lives of other characters who felt real and important and believable, and I felt passionate about them and deeply about them. But I knew that eventually Ella May was going to touch them somehow. And it was just so pleasurable to see. You know, when you're writing, you think you're in control, but you're not. Your characters are in control. And there were so many moments where characters revealed to me how they knew Ella May, and it was just wonderful to watch it unfold.
At the opening of the show, I played the Mill Mother's Lament. It was on an album by Pete Seeger. Are you a fan of folk music, of this? We have a local author, Stephanie Legend, who wrote a book, Homegrown Music. It focuses on bluegrass, but it also talks about how in Appalachia and especially deep in the South, the songs become the stories. They have their own language that they tell their children. They tell their stories through song. The slaves used to sing to tell their stories. Was this something that fascinated you ahead of time, or you just, as you learned more about Ella May?
It absolutely fascinated me. You know, I grew up in North Carolina in the western part of the state, and I went to graduate school in Louisiana in 2003, and I found myself really, really homesick. And one of the things that I started doing was actively listening to all this folk music that I'd passively heard growing up. And it let me be back in parts of North Carolina that I loved. And one of the great things about researching this novel is there was great music written around the strike. There's a wonderful CD from a record company in Durham, North Carolina, called Old Hat Records. There's a CD called Gastonia Gallop, which is all mill music that came out of Gastonia in between the wars. And the lyrics are fascinating. They're mired in poverty. They're struggling. A lot of these people are from Appalachia, and they've come down to the good life promised by the mills. And they brought their banjos with them. They brought their guitars and their harmonicas and their fiddles. And they start making music about life in these mill villages. And the lyrics say things like, I can't make enough money to move away. And Ella was part of this. Ella brought these mountain ballads down the mountain with her. And when she got to Gastonia and got involved in the strike, she began to change the words to some of these mountain ballads, and she made them into protest songs about conditions on the ground and in these mill villages and surrounding the strike. And as you said, Pete Seeger went on to record her music. Woody Guthrie performed it and called her the greatest American songwriter of all time. And it's just a testament to her power and to her role in American cultural history and the American labor movement. And it hits home the fact that she was literally disappeared from history, you know.
It's completely astonishing, because there have been other in the '60s protest songs were written again, and it seems as if history times change, but people don't, and it may be different players, but it seems as if we relive these same situations over and over and over, and. Just to vanish like that, and I was going to ask you, but I think you've sort of already answered it. Were you able to connect with any of Ella May's descendants, or descendants of anyone from this time period?
I was. I've heard from her great-grandson, a guy up in upstate New York who was a labor leader all his life, although his grandmother, who was LMA's youngest, begged her children and grandchildren, don't join the union because the union will kill you like they killed my mother. And I've heard and got to be friends with LMA's great-granddaughter, who wrote a wonderful book about her called The Martyr of the Loria Mill Strike. The author's name is Christina Horton, and she is LMA's great-granddaughter, and she and I have been in contact a good bit, and I met her at the release in Asheville a couple of nights ago, and it was just a pleasure to meet her. I was nervous, but it was a pleasure to meet her.
So, does she approve of her great grandmother's story?
She seemed happy. You know, we had a big evening. I was in conversation with Charles Fraser, who wrote Cold Mountain. He's mm-hmm. a friend of mine. We talked about mill towns and historical novels and research and strong women in American literature. And then one of my favorite musicians, a woman named Shannon Whitworth, who's a singer-songwriter in North Carolina, she came and performed LMA's best-known song, Mill Mother's Lament. And there were about 600 people there in attendance, and she just slayed them. It was just one of the most beautiful things I've ever witnessed.
You had 600 people at your book launch?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. That's amazing. What did you find most fascinating about Ella's life?
What I found most fascinating about Ella's life was that the struggles that she faced are still being faced by working mothers and by working families. You know, the only difference between Ella Mae's life and the life of the working poor now is that we have safety nets, some of them which are illusory to many people, and some of them are illusions to some of us. And what's also shocked me about this novel is the grip of generational poverty. You know, America is the land of the free and the home of the brave, and you can pull yourself up by your bootstraps. But some people don't have straps on their boots, and they don't have boots, and they're standing out barefoot in the rain, and nobody's coming to save them. And it's hard to climb out of that kind of hole when you have a child. It's even harder to climb out of that kind of hole when that child has a child. And a lot of people get left behind who don't deserve to be left behind. Ella Mae worked 72 hours a week on the night shift and earned $9. Her struggle wasn't a matter of not working hard enough. It was a matter of working too hard.
I just find it so rare. I can't even fathom that people treat other people that way. And I know they do all the time. That's something I can't, it's beyond my comprehension, I think.
Well, I just read a story online that, and this is not in America, it was in Japan, that a 31-year-old reporter worked 139 hours of overtime in a month a couple of years ago, and it just came out that she literally died of being overworked. Her heart gave out.
It's mind-boggling.
Yeah.
And that people continue to do it. The human spirit doesn't die because I need to feed my children. I need to
sure.
clothe them. It's just incredible. So the last ballot was a Library Reads pick for October. Library Reads is a list that librarians put together of the books that they are most anxious for, and the only disappointment in that was I did not get to write the annotation for it.
My friend Ron Block did. I've known Ron for a while. He was a big supporter of my first book, as were you, though.
Oh, thank you. And I love novels that make me feel exhausted in a good way. The dark, gothic-y kind of thing. And your first book, A Land More Kind Than Home, I was on a Ron Rash, Tom Franklin binge, the both other Southern authors, when the nice ladies, they were all ladies, I think, at the time, from HarperCollins, sent me A Land More Kind Than Home and said, you have to read this.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And it was just, it was a story of the preacher who was in a Georgia prison and laid his hands on a young autistic boy, and the boy dies, and then how this community struggles with it. Your prose is just so lyrical, and it draws the readers into the characters who, most of your characters are damaged in your previous two books, but they're not beyond redemption. Would you say that's a fair?
I think so. I think we're all damaged in some way, and we're all, you know, striking out and trying to connect with other people and trying to make sense of the world. And I think sometimes the objective reader has a better sense of where that damage is than the characters do themselves. And that's always kind of an exciting thing to try to unfold in a novel.
And your first novel was told in three voices. And your second one, This Dark Road to Mercy, was also told in three voices. It was a story of two young sisters who are in the foster care system, and their father a minor league baseball player comes and kidnaps them. And I seem to remember a circus scene in that book, which would make it not one of my favorite books because I have a circus phobia.
Oh, this is a big outdoor pavilion fair.
It feels like
a circus environment, though.
Okay, I feel better now about that. So how do you feel about being compared, not compared to, but put in a class with the Ron Rashes of the world?
I love it. You know, Ron's a friend of mine, and I wouldn't have a book out in the world if a guy like Ron hadn't come before me. So I love it. I think Ron is our Robert Frost, and I wish more people read him.
He is spectacular, and I think one of the things I do at the library is select the books, and I always make sure we have enough copies of his, put them out. Do you have other favorite Southern authors, or do you not read Southern authors in particular?
I read a lot of all the authors. You know, one of the great things about being in the book industry now for the short amount of time I've been into it is that I get advanced copies just like you do. I hear buzz in booksellers. I hear buzz from the reps at HarperCollins and from my editor. And, you know, books that I've been really excited about this year, obviously, Jessamyn Ward by himself. And
it's a prequel to Practically Magic. Practical Magic.
No, I'm sorry. I meant Alice McDermott.
The Ninth Hour.
I'll be with Alice Hoffman, though, in Providence. I'm thrilled about meeting her, but I was talking about Alice
McDermott, The Ninth Hour.
The Ninth Hour. It's just amazing. So I've been looking forward to her new book as well.
It is, The Ninth Hour is, it's chilling.
Yeah.
It is chilling. The child of a family from Brooklyn, it's scary.
Yeah, but as far as Southern authors, you know, it's the usual suspects. Ron Rash, Tom Franklin, Lee Smith, Joe McCorkle, Randall Keenan, Ernest Gaines, you know, and going back farther, Flannery O'Connor, Eudora Welty, William Faulkner, Thomas Wolfe, Gene Toomer.
Is that what you mostly read in school?
You know, in school, before my undergraduate, I kind of just read whatever was put in front of me.
Okay.
And I didn't really have a reading aesthetic when I was that young. But in college, I began to kind of form an aesthetic that led me to writers who wrote about a place, who wrote about a distinct place, and kind of wrote evocations of a place that meant something to them, and that always left a big impression on me. So I was really drawn to Ernest Gaines, and that's why I went to graduate school in Louisiana. I had the opportunity to study fiction writing under him, and that's why I went down there.
That's quite an opportunity to study with him.
It was.
A la Pamela Paul from the New York Times book review section by the book, what's on your nightstand now besides The Ninth Hour?
Gosh, what is on my nightstand now besides The Ninth Hour? One of my good friends back in Wilmington, North Carolina, his name's Kevin Maurer, and he has a new book he's co-authored called American Radical, and it's about an undercover Muslim FBI agent. That'll be out later in October, and that book's just an eye-burner. It's gonna be a big one. They're going to be on 60 Minutes in a couple of weeks, and that's going to be a really, really big book. But I read a new book called Goodbye Vitamin that I really enjoyed, mm-hmm. a really tight, trim little novel. Alyssa Nutting's new book, Made for Love, was just this almost satirical romp with just these deep, heartfelt moments in it that were really surprising and really delicious to experience. But I've been kind of besieged by books. I went to SIBA, which is the Southern Independent Booksellers Alliance convention, 2 weeks ago and just came home with a ton of galleys. My wife's just like waiting at the door with her hands outstretched to get all the free galleys that I brought home. But there's a lot of good books. I mean, the fall is a good time for books to come out. And I know it's a crapshoot having my small little mill novel come out, but I wanted it out in the fall to be in this great company. And also the fall is a great time to go on a book tour in America.
Yes, it is. Now, where else are you? You're not coming to the East Coast, are you? The Mid-Atlantic?
I'm coming. Farthest north I'm going on the East Coast is Providence, Rhode Island. I've got a lot of stops in North Carolina and South Carolina. I'll be in Atlanta. I've got several stops in Texas, Houston, and Austin. I'll be out in Spokane. I'll be in Columbus, Ohio, and Cleveland, Ohio. And then in the spring, I'll be in Vail, Colorado. I'll be in Charlottesville, Virginia.
I'm not hearing New York City anywhere in here.
Not near New York City just yet, but maybe we can figure something out.
I think so. I think you'd be. I'd bring a whole busload of people.
I would love that
to see you. Have we learned anything since LMA's time? Do you think, as a society?
I don't know. I think we've been more aware of patterns. You know, in the closing days of writing this novel about a strong, independent woman calling for unity while standing up to the forces of greed, I'm watching an election cycle in which a tough, independent woman is calling for unity and standing up to the forces of greed. And that's not a smear against the president. I think he would be very happy that I considered him the force of greed. I think that would make him, he'd be delighted by that, actually. And then the day after the election, I realized, you know, oh my gosh, America's telling me they don't want to read a novel about a strong woman like this. But then the day after the election, and literally every day after the election, I feel like America's telling me, yes, we do want to read a novel about a woman like Ella May, who faces this thing head on. And what's been kind of terrifying is the similarities that keep unfolding. You know, the day that there's this raid on the Strikers' headquarters, there's a huge Confederate rally in Charlotte. And these police officers go over there and get drunk, and they march with the Confederates, and they go back to this tent colony and do violence against these Strikers. And then we see the murder of Heather Heyer when this mad, crazed white supremacist drives his car into a group of protesters. Well, that's how Ella May was killed. Somebody drove a car into a group of protesters and turned over her car, and then they shot her. And so these similarities have been, depending on your political stripe and your either, you know, whatever political movement you embrace, these similarities have been heartbreaking for me.
What inspires you to, or what inspired you to keep going through Ella May's story that could have dragged you down?
You know, I worked on this novel for 5 years, and what could have dragged me down was just trying to find my way to her, because she was so elusive. There's just not much known about her. And I felt great freedom, but in that freedom I was sometimes paralyzed by all the options that I have, and I wanted to honor her. I didn't want to make her a saint, because she wasn't a saint. She was tough. I mean, she would punch you in the face and kick you in the shin and steal your wallet, and then she'd march for workers' rights and take care of her children. You know, she was tough. She wanted to survive beyond anything. And I didn't want to write a hagiography where I'm sainting her, because that's not who she was, and she wouldn't have wanted that either. Her children wouldn't have wanted that. But I struggled to find the balance, and I know I found it. I feel like Ella May lives on the page more than any character I've ever written about. And so that could have dragged me down, but it didn't. It really emboldened me, and it pushed me to finish this book.
Okay, she wasn't a saint. Was she a hero, or are we too quick to call people heroes?
I think she was absolutely a hero. You know, we see history as being this fixed thing. You know, the Declaration of Independence was signed on July 4, 1776. But a lot of things happened that day. A lot of people were there in that room who didn't sign the Declaration. There were a lot of people cooking food and perhaps pouring water, sweeping up and taking care of horses and carriages and things like that. There were people, you know, tending to the gardens, perhaps. History is not one single defined moment. And so for some people in the community, the mill owners, the newspaper that wrote these violent screeds against the Union and against the Strikers, Ella May absolutely was not a hero. But for her children that she was willing to die to save, she absolutely was a hero. And I'd prefer to see her through her children's eyes than the eyes of a wealthy mill owner.
Okay, I just have two more quick questions for you. I know housekeeping's going to be knocking at your door shortly to move you along. You have two children.
I do.
What do you hope they take away from this someday?
This sounds so self-indulgent to say this, but
you're entitled, I think.
I feel like my children take away from a book like this that their father cared. That their father cared about the story, about a story about a woman like Ella May Wiggins. That their father believed in the rights of humanity and the equality of all people. And that I was willing to take a stand and put a stake in their future.
And are you working on something? I always ask, what are you working on next? I know your book just came out and you want to rest, you know, celebrate this and enjoy this. Do you have anything percolating in the back?
I do a little bit. I know it's going to be set in North Carolina. That's really all that I know. I've got a couple of ideas tumbling around in there, and I'm under contract for another book, so I have to begin something sooner than later. But,
well, that's good news.
Yeah, but right now I don't quite know. But I'm kind of looking forward to getting started. A friend of Joe McCorkle, a writer friend of mine in North Carolina, says she knows it's time to start a new book when she's ready to let go of the old one. And I think I'm finally ready to let go of The Last Ballad, which is good because it's on bookstores and library shelves across America that I'm willing to let go.
Well, it's not on our library shelves because it's out already.
Wonderful.
All our copies are out. So is there anything you'd like to leave us with? Or
No, just I really appreciate you doing this, Jennifer.
And oh, I am
see
so...
as many people on the road as possible. And you can go to my website, wileycash.com, follow me on Twitter, follow me on Facebook. And thanks for doing this with
well,
me.
Well, thank you. I was so thrilled. You know, I sent this little tweet out, would you maybe want to be on this little radio show we have going? And when people answer yes, I'm thrilled. And I'm just delighted to talk to you because I have been a huge fan since your first book.
Thank you, Jennifer.
All right, so best of luck. Good luck tonight.
And
I hope your event goes so well, and I will look forward to meeting you one day.
Absolutely.
All right, thanks so much. Bye-bye. Okay, so I was just talking with Wiley Cash, the author of The Last Ballad, and it is 11:45 right now, so we will go to our last commercial break, and then we'll go through some of the programs coming up this week at the library.
Are you struggling to find the right person to stay in that critical role in your company? Trying to attract and retain millennials? Regional Personnel is your staffing solution. Located in Lebanon, New Jersey, Regional Personnel is an ASA-certified, privately held staffing and recruiting firm providing you with everything from temporary to permanent employees. As ASA-certified professionals, we employ the latest tools and techniques to find, screen, and present to you the best talent that fits your needs. The result? Access to top talent in the shortest time with the lowest chance of turnover. We guarantee it. So call Regional today at 908-534-8113 or visit us on the web at regionalpersonnel.com.
Did you know that 1 in 5 people are affected by mental illness? NAMI Hunterdon is the locally affiliate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We are all volunteers, and all our programs are free of charge. We offer Family to Family, a 12-week course for families that have an adult member with a mental illness. Another popular program is In Our Own Voice, where individuals who are living with mental illness discuss their challenges and their progress in overcoming those challenges. Another course we offer is Basics, a 6-week course for families with a child or an adolescent who has experienced mental illness. We also have a monthly support group for families on the third Thursday of every month. Please call NAMI Hunterdon at 908-284-0500 for more information about any of our programs or to join. NAMI Hunterdon, the voice for mental health in Hunterdon County.
Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's Physician Referral Service at 1-800-511-4-HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
Advancing Hunterdon is an ever-sharp focus on the growth and prosperity of Hunterdon County's businesses. Advancing Hunterdon engages businesses within and throughout the county that are responsive to a call to action as the next chapter in business success. If your business and organization wants to get engaged, contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. Advancing Hunterdon, a roadmap for economic growth for the business community of Hunterdon.
Welcome back to the Library Show. I'm Jennifer Winberry, and Jim Thatch usually likes to give a traffic report on Main Street, and there is an emergency vehicle traveling down Main Street right now, so be careful, guys. I am missing Jim Thatch today because the building is shrouded in plastic. It looks like they're removing paint and scraping today, and I'm pretty sure that we could do a haunted house thing or something, or lack of air in the building. But anyway, Jim will be back next week. He's taking care of some family business today. Jim Gano will be in 10 short minutes to take care of some business. And right now, I just want to catch you up on some of the library programs coming up this week. If you have not yet had a chance to see the Manhattan Short Film Festival, which is 10 short films selected from over 1,600 submissions, that are being screened around the world before being submitted to the Academy Awards. You have one last chance this Saturday afternoon at 2 p.m. at the Headquarters Library. It's about 2 hours long to see all 10 of the shorts. Come watch them, vote for your favorite, and talk about your favorite with the other members of the audience. And if you missed The Zookeeper's Wife, which is based on a book by Diane Ackerman, the real-life story of a couple in 1939 Poland who have a flourishing zoo, and then they deal with the shock of the German invasion. That's being shown on Thursday, October 12th at 6 p.m. at the headquarters library. And if you did not get to see that in the theater, you definitely should take the chance to see it. I saw the previews, and it looked absolutely fabulous. October 17th, we're going to have a representative from the New Jersey Division of Taxation, and she's going to give a presentation on PTR and homestead rebates, including how to properly fill out the forms to maximize your return from your PTR tax freeze. This program is at 7 o'clock on Tuesday, October 17th, and it was offered at the Hunterdon County Senior Center one afternoon earlier this year, so if you missed it, you'll have another chance to see it at the library. And we had last week we had Senator Menendez's mobile office at the library, and we've had a series of fall mobile office hours, Assemblyman Andrew Zwicker. The mobile office hours provide constituents opportunities to receive support in matters related to state agencies, voice their opinions on state issues, and familiarize themselves with services available through the legislative offices. And we're going to have them at the headquarters library in the lobby. There will be one on Wednesday, October 18th, and another one on Wednesday, November 15th, and then again on Wednesday, December 20th. And these are between 5:30 and 7:30. And there's just a table set up and a young woman, Crystal. She has some information that you can take home with you, or she'll just sit and talk with you if you have any concerns. She's a wonderful representative for the office, and she's been quite helpful to several patrons already. And that evening, October 18th, we will welcome back Ravon, the trio that plays the music of Buddy Holly, Roy Orbison, and other legends of the rock and roll early years. There's Chris Rozell, Pete Farley, and Don Ginta. It features things such as That'll Be the Day, Peggy Sue, Not Fade Away, Pretty Woman. This is the music that paved the way for rock and roll and influenced groups such as the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Bob Dylan, Bruce Springsteen. This show usually fills up. It's 7 o'clock on October 18th, so you do want to register for the program, 908-788-1434, or since you are already on our website, on the internet, go to our website, hclibrary.us, click on the calendar of events, and register that way. And the other reason you want to register is if in the event that we have inclement weather, which let's not hope we don't have any in October, or if something happens and the band needs to postpone, we can call you so you don't make the trip to the library and are disappointed. Many of our programs, funding has been made possible in part by the New Jersey State Council on the Arts and Humanities, Department of State, a partner agency of the National Endowment for the Arts, through funds administered by the Hunterdon County Cultural and Heritage Commission. And we do thank them for their support, because without their support, we would not be able to offer as many programs as we do. We try to do two musical programs a month at each location headquarters and the North County branch, and also fill in the slots with some different speakers. On November 4th, yes, we're less than a month away, we're going to welcome back the author Marta McDowell. Marta's a master gardener and a botanical landscape historian. She's from North New Jersey. She wrote a book on Beatrix Potter's and her stories. Her new book is The World of Laura Ingalls Wilder, The Frontier Landscapes That Inspired the Little House Brooks. And if you've listened to the show before, you have probably heard Jim kind of razz me about being such a Little House on the Prairie fan. And this book is just, it's absolutely gorgeous. It tells the story of the plants and the places of the beloved author of the Little House series. It explores Wilder's deep relationship with the landscapes, and it follows her wagon trail starting in Wisconsin, the setting of Little House in the Big Woods, through the Dakotas and to Missouri, where she lived her life as an adult with her husband Almanzo and her daughter Rose. She also spent some time in Florida, or she thought it would help her husband's health. It did not, so she went back to Missouri. And Laura Ingalls Wilder, as an adult, wrote an agricultural column for a local newspaper. So plants were always a big part of her life. It wasn't just gathering the roses with her sister Mary when they went walking on the prairie, or the violets, the prairie violets. So you'll learn the details about Wilder's life and inspiration, discover how to visit the real places today, and learn how to grow the plants and vegetables featured in this series. And the book series that most of us grew up with have the Garth Williams illustrations, the fabulous Garth Williams, who also illustrated the E.B. White book, Stuart Little, Charlotte's Web, that we all know and love. But Helen Sewell illustrated the original Little House on the Prairie books, and some of those illustrations are included throughout the book, and it's really a lovely book for all fans of Little House on the Prairie. So she will be here on November 4th. It's a Saturday afternoon at 2 p.m., and the book garden will be on hand to sell books, and Marta will sign them for us. Halloween is coming up, and the North County Branch Library on Wednesday, October 25th at 7 p.m. will welcome Gordon Thomas Ward to talk about ghosts, have a ghostly discussion. Ward says that one of his favorite parts of this presentation on ghosts and hauntings comes from the brief question and answer period at the end of each show. Ghostly discussions is an opportunity for the audience to participate in developing theories, view Gordon's forensic evidence, and share their questions and experiences. What are the ghosts? Should we fear them? What happens to our spirits when our bodies die? Any of these questions and more can be addressed in this very unique multimedia presentation that examines ghostly paranormal events within an open forum. And to register for our North County branch programs, you want to call 730-6135. The Garden Club at the North County Branch Library meets the third Tuesday of every month. This month it's meeting October 7th at 7 p.m., and the speaker this month will be Dr. Tom Umbrello, Senior Professor of Biology History at Union County Community College. And he'll be talking about the story of Union County College's historic tree project, which began in 1997. It's collecting seeds or cuttings of noteworthy historic trees around the country and in New Jersey. Offspring trees are grown in the college's greenhouse and outdoor nursery, and then they're planted in the historic tree grove established on the Cranford campus. The college recently donated the 16-year-old offspring of the descendant of the Basking Ridge oak, white oak, which stood in front of the Basking Ridge Presbyterian Church until this past April. The 600-year-old parent tree was thought to be the oldest white oak in the country and the world, and it had to be taken down from the green in Basking Ridge. But if you've ever been through Basking Ridge, through that little square, you've certainly seen the tree. But there is an offspring, and now it is part of this tree project where it will be preserved for future generations. So I think that's about it for today. I would once again like to thank Wiley Cash for taking time out of his schedule to talk with me. Definitely pick up his book, The Last Ballad. We do have copies in the library, so place a hold on them, and you'll get it when it comes back. Or order it from your local bookseller. I also want to thank Virginia and Amanda and Chris from HarperCollins Library Love Fest, who share their love and enthusiasm for books with librarians around the country daily. And they've been very supportive, and they love to send us books, and we love to talk about them. So I hope to feature more HarperCollins authors in the future. So again, thanks for listening. Jim Gannot will be in very shortly. Remember, wherever you are, you can call, stop in, or go online. Your library is always there for you. Good night.
The news is sponsored by the Hunt.
You USA Radio News with Chris Barnes.
President Trump is praising the rescue of an American woman and her Canadian husband in the Pakistan-Afghan border region, saying in a statement they were rescued in a joint U.S.-Pakistan operation. The president calling it a positive moment in U.S.-Pakistani relations. Caitlin Coleman, Joshua Boyle, and their child were kidnapped in 2012 while backpacking through Afghanistan. The couple had two more children while they were being held. President Trump expected to announce the U.S. will decertify the Iran nuclear deal. Here's Bill Zimpfer.
A decertification would basically throw the ball to Congress, giving them 60 days to decide whether to restore sanctions against Iran or impose new sanctions. The decision to decertify goes against the wishes of other countries who are part of the agreement and some members of the president's own cabinet.
USA Radio News.
Attention homeowners, why do you throw away hundreds of dollars every month to the electric company when you can save thousands of dollars over time with a solar energy system that increases the value of your home and eventually can have you enjoying no monthly payment at all? Green Solar Technologies has years of experience as leaders in residential and commercial solar systems and is proud to be a platinum installer for SolarWorld, the country's top-selling manufacturer of American-made solar panels. Call 800-413-3427 today for a free estimate and to take advantage of current tax credits, grants, and rebates, which can save you even more. Green Solar Technologies guides you through every step, including financing options, which will allow you to enjoy all the benefits of solar power for zero down, zero payments, and zero interest for the first year. Stop paying high energy bills and start saving money today by calling Green Solar Technologies at 800-413-3427. That's 800-413-3427. 800-413-3427.
A big disaster aid package expected to be approved by the U.S. House this afternoon.
Tax grants and rebates, which can save you even more.
USA Radio News with Chris Barnes.
The Pentagon is reportedly investigating the deaths of U.S. soldiers, four of them killed in an attack by terrorists affiliated with ISIS in Niger early this month. Republican Senator John McCain has accused the Trump administration of withholding information about the attack. Here's more from Sharon Reed.
The Arizona Republican said no when a reporter asked if he thought the administration is being upfront about the attack by terrorists affiliated with ISIS. Correspondent Carol Lee says the Trump administration is facing growing pressure from lawmakers.
The University of Florida is stepping up security ahead of today's speech by white nationalist Richard Spencer, as hundreds of state troopers are already positioned to provide security. Governor Rick Scott declaring a state of emergency in that county, saying Spencer's speeches have led to violence and arrests in previous cases. This is USA Radio News.
For many businesses, hiring is tough, which makes it critical to choose the right place to post your jobs. You need qualified candidates fast and on budget, and you don't want to sign a long-term contract or pay upfront fees. That's why you need Indeed.com, the world's number one job site. Independent research shows Indeed delivers six times more hires than any other job site. You can post a job in minutes and even set up screener questions to help you zero in on qualified candidates. You can review applicants, take notes, and schedule interviews, all from an easy-to-use online dashboard. For a limited time, Indeed is offering new users a $50 credit to make their first job listing a sponsored job with premium visibility so more candidates will see it. You want to make a great hire fast, and this exclusive offer gives you a head start. Find out why over 3 million businesses use Indeed for hiring. To redeem this offer, go to Indeed.com/radio. That's Indeed.com/radio. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Weekly jobless claims are at the lowest they've been in more than 40 years. The Labor Department reporting this morning that 222,000 Americans filed first-time claims for unemployment benefits last week, and that's 22,000 fewer than the previous week and the lowest weekly total since March of 1973.
actor-producer Channing Tatum now pulling a movie that he's had in the works with the now-disgraced Harvey Weinstein and the Weinstein Company, Tatum cutting all ties with that studio. Here's Mark Mayfield.
The Magic Mike star and producing partner Reed Carolyn announced in a statement on Wednesday that they won't develop a film about high school sexual abuse or anything else at the Weinstein Company. They're pulling out because of growing claims of sexual harassment, abuse, and rape against former studio chief Harvey Weinstein. Tatum tweeted that the women who have come forward about Weinstein are heroes to him and Carolyn.
Forecasters say it's good news for the fight against wildfires in Northern California. The first rain of the season is to start later today and continue tonight. This is USA Radio News.
Attention floor buyers. The 6th annual fall flooring yard sale is going on now at Lumber Liquidators. Get high quality flooring at low yard sale prices, like Woodlook waterproof floors from just 39 cents. All Dream Home X2O water resistant laminate is on sale. Prefinished hardwood is starting at $149. Get more deals in store while supplies last. Plus,